You're listening to Beyond Busy, the show where we ask the bigger questions about work. My name's Graham Alcott. I'm your host for the show. And I have to say, like, my throat is absolutely dying. Like, I've just had this awful cold all week. I've had a really bad cough. And so what that means for you is there's going to be very little preamble this week. I'm just going to go straight into the episode. I'm talking to Teresa Houston. She is the author of this book, Let's Talk, Make Effective Feedback Your Superpower. And I think this is a really timely and useful book. And there's a couple of studies recently, that one that found that 37% of managers dread giving feedback. And another one found that 65% of employees wish their managers gave more feedback. And I've been thinking about this a lot because as part of the Kindness Happening, one of our challenges for the week was to give kind feedback. And I've realized that it's something that I need to do a lot more than I currently am doing. We had this whole kind of challenge around it, encouraging us to try and give at least 4 pieces of feedback a day. And I thought that'd be easy. It was surprisingly hard. So I'm going to lay down that challenge for you. We called it the 4 Quarters Challenge. I'll put a link in the show notes here to the blog post that I've done about it. But basically, get 4 coins, put them in your left-hand pocket or on the left-hand side of your desk. Every time you give feedback throughout the day, move one of those coins to the right-hand side and try and do that every day. Give at least 4 bits of feedback a day and just make it just the norm. Make it the expectation that this is something that we always do rather than a thing that we resort to when the work is bad or the work is amazing, but you're giving feedback across that full spectrum. So that's my little challenge to you, and let's get straight into the conversation. So really enjoyed this. Here's my conversation with Teresa Houston. Cool. We are rolling. I'm with Teresa Houston. How are you?
I'm doing so well, Graham. It's great to be here.
Yeah. And you're Seattle, and I'm in very dark Brighton. So the miracle of the internet means that you're starting your day as I'm ending my day.
Yes. Yes. And I don't know that it's much brighter here. You know, if you've ever been to Seattle, it's gray. People complain about the rain, but really the darkness is what's hard. Yeah.
Yeah. I had one night in Seattle, which was a really memorable one. My favorite band is an Australian band called Hiatus Coyote.
Oh, nice.
And I was traveling from Portland, somewhere south of Seattle. I can't remember where I was going next, but basically I managed to reroute my trip for one night only and catch them in Seattle. And it was just like this really rock and roll thing in the middle of a business trip.
Oh, you've been to more concerts in Seattle now than I have.
Really?
Right? Yeah. My husband plays trombone. So we'll go to either his concerts or we'll go to jazz shows. Okay. But in terms of like a rock and roll band.
Oh, yeah. Well, Hiatus Coyote are quite jazz actually, but they're, yeah, kind of jazz electronic, I guess a bit of rock too. But they were playing in one of the rock venues in the middle of a big long street in the center of town. I can't even remember what the place was called, but there you go. Mm-hmm. So that was my one day in Seattle, probably pretty sleepless in Seattle too.
Yeah, probably.
And you're not a Seattle Seahawks fan, right? Are you Cleveland Browns? Did I read?
You are good. You did your research.
There you
yes.
Go.
Yeah. Yeah. Football in America. American football is a big thing. And I grew up loving the Cleveland Browns, which is a team that perhaps no one in the UK has ever heard of because they've never won a Super Bowl. But I was so much of a Browns fan. I'm sure there's some parallel in soccer where we would go to training camp. Because you didn't have to pay. We didn't have much money when I was growing up. We would go to training camp in the summer. And when the players were done, they would come and they'd sign autographs.
Oh, nice.
And we would wait at the sidelines. Oh, my goodness. I was a very diehard fan. And then if we had enough money to go to a game during the season, we would go. But I was a real football fan growing up.
Well, I think we're kindred sporting spirits because my football team is Aston Villa. And we actually shared the same owner for a little while. Randy Lerner was the owner of the Cleveland Browns and of Aston Villa. And I think basically ruined both.
both franchises? Oh, yes. That's too bad. And I noticed you have a jersey hanging on behind you. Is that?
Yeah, that's an Aston Villa 1982 European Cup winning jersey signed by the entire team. It's a little prized possession, eh?
That is. Nice job. Very good. Yeah.
So let's talk about your book, Let's Talk. Hey.
Sure.
So the book is Let's Talk, Make Effective Feedback Your Superpower. Really enjoyed reading it. And we should probably start with your story at the beginning about how your boss tried to give you feedback, but you were both on the toilet.
Yes. So I had been, this was a couple of jobs ago, but it was, I was first year in the job. And my boss was someone who often would let you know how your work was going, but it was annual performance review time. I'd been there a full year, and I had asked her, could we have a conversation about how this year has gone for me? And she said, of course, why don't we do this over lunch? I'm like, okay, great. Let's, you know, keep it relaxed. So we went out to, she took me to a very nice restaurant, and the whole lunch experience, we talked about other things. We talked about, I was engaged. We talked about my engagement and the marriage to come. We talked about her family. We talked about our pets. But we didn't talk about my performance, right? So it was lovely, but we didn't get into what the purpose was. So towards the very end of the lunch, I see that we're leaving. I'm trying to figure out, how am I going to bring this up? How am I going to bring up performance review? I figure, well, I'll bring it up on the walk back to our offices, because we walked to this restaurant. But before we leave, we go to use the restroom, the public restroom at the restaurant. And while we're both in the loo, she starts to say, oh, so by the way, Therese, you asked me how you were doing. Like, no, not here. Because you know, you don't know who's going to walk in. I can't write any of this down. I mean, there's so many ways in which this was awkward. And she was only saying positive things, which was great, but it was still, it was one of these critical moments where someone was trying to, and she was super busy. She had just taken on a new role herself. I understand what was going on for her. I don't think this represented her best feedback moment ever. But she was busy, and she was just trying to squeeze me in. But it was, that was a hard moment. And it was kind of funny, because then on the walk back to her office, I'm like, can I bring this up again? can I ask for more feedback, or was that it?
Are we done now? Is that it?
Are we done? Oh my goodness. Oh.
And so do you think that's because, like, so there was a thing in your book that says 37% of managers dread giving feedback, but then 65% of people want more feedback. So do you think in that moment she decided, I'm just going to have a nice lunch, I'm going to just get to know Therese more, rather than actually, you know, do the thing that we're supposed to be here to do? Do you think it's that kind of dread and avoidance?
Well, you know, in her case, I'm not sure that that's what it was. It could have been, because you're right. At least in the US, I don't know how the numbers are different in the UK, but in the US, surveys show that about 1 in 3 managers really dread feedback conversations. And the managers that I've interviewed think that number is grossly underreported. They think it's at least 50%. Yeah. So it could have been that she was dreading it. But I think what was more likely is she, I wasn't a problem child. I was one of the employees that was a high performer. I can think of 1 or 2 other people on the team that perhaps she was frustrated with, that those conversations might have been harder. And so I think that for me, she was just like, what do we need to talk about? Everything's smooth sailing. And that's an interesting issue too for managers. I think all too often, as managers, if you know, you've got the employees who take a lot of your attention and coaching, and you've got employees who are just so easy that you're grateful, and you don't think that they also need to hear praise, that they need to hear which of the things that I'm most grateful that you do, or here's the impact that you're having. When you do this, you make my job easier. And that's the kind of praise so many of us appreciate, because now we know where to pivot, where to set aside our own work so that we can help. Because ultimately, you know, in any job, even though it's not written down, our job is to make our boss look better, right? Ultimately, your job is to make your boss look better. And so if your boss can let you know what helps them do their job, or what makes them look better, you know, maybe you're not going to be that crass and put it that way, but it can really be illuminating as an employee.
Yeah. And you talk about feedback being a superpower, and, you know, the idea that a thing that you can do can have this, you know, huge, you know, sort of snowball effect on lots of other people around you. And so do you think that is because we tend to focus on giving feedback to the people who are seen as underperforming or problematic, rather than necessarily seeing it as something that we all need to you know, regularly hear as well as regularly give as well?
I do think we need to regularly hear it. In terms of there being a snowball effect, I think that it's one of the most you know, when we think about productivity strategies, giving good feedback is one of the ways we can immediately make everyone around us more productive. You know, if you're giving recognition or praise, you're letting a person know, this is what I want you to lean into. I need you to be that good with clients, or I need you to get stronger. You know, you're already good at negotiating and I need you to continue to lean into that superpower, right? So we allow people to get more efficient with their time. Plus, we're now going to spend less time having to figure out who do I want to assign to blank, because I know what the strengths are on my team. I know who's going to be good at that or who's looking for an opportunity to develop. So I do really think that there's a snowball effect. It makes us more productive as managers. And of course, there's also emotional issues. If you're, you know, if someone gives you bad feedback, Graham, it takes up so much of your energy, right? Yeah. To process it. You're processing it with your partner. You're processing it with other people on your team. Like, what? Where did that come from? And it uses up a lot of emotional energy when we're not receiving good feedback, or if we're bad at giving it, right? Because then you ruminate over how you're going to say it. So there are a lot of different ways that you can have either a positive snowball effect or a negative snowball effect in either direction, depending on whether it's a skill you're developing or a skill you're avoiding.
What do you think about the different generations in the workplace around this? So there was a bit in the book where you talk about millennials are more interested in feedback than my generation, the Gen X generation, and baby boomers, and millennials want something in terms of feedback more on a week to week or month to month basis, whereas baby boomers and Gen Xers are much more like once a quarter or, you know, once every 6 months or so. What do you think about the challenges there of obviously different generations managing each other and those kind of different cultural expectations?
Well, I have different thoughts there. So I know a number of people who just chalk this up either as millennials or Gen Z are less secure, or they want more praise. You know, they want a blue ribbon for everything. And so there are some people who take that view, that the reason that millennials and Gen Z are seeking more feedback is because they have been brought up in environments where they get really frequent praise, or they want that reassurance. So that's one camp, and I can see where that's coming from. But there's another camp. I've been interviewing a number of managers, and they've pointed out that when they were in their 20s, you know, they're now in their 40s or their 50s, but they point out when they were in their 20s, they didn't know what they were good at. Right? When you think about it. Yeah. You know, you're kind of like, I'm not sure what I do well compared to other people. I mean, I know what I do, but I don't know how it really compares to them. So that really has got me thinking that part of what could be happening there is we're not sure what's distinctive, what unique contributions each of us bring in our 20s. By the time we're in our 30s or 40s, we're starting to get a sense of both what we like to do and what we're good at. So there could be that element as well, that any generation when they're in their 20s is trying to chip away at what are the things that I actually do uniquely well? What's distinctive about me? So I think there's probably both of those probably contribute. But I thought that was a good insight, that when you're young, you're not sure what you do well.
Yeah, I wonder if the other thing around that is that for millennials and then Gen Z, as we would call them,
Gen Z,
yes. As you'll call them.
Gen Z, sure.
I wonder if, you know, those younger generations, the fact is they're coming into a workplace environment that is changing so much more quickly than when we started our first jobs, right? And so just that sense of needing the frequency of feedback to be faster is because I suppose people look at 9 months as being the sort of typical, you know, sort of shelf life of a job rather than 3 or 4 years as probably we did maybe.
Oh, so very interesting. Yeah. So you're thinking maybe about the turnover, the fact that people change careers so much more often.
Yeah. And you and roles and, you know, there's this kind of sense. I think there's a sense at the moment about lots of the jobs that people will end up doing from the sort of Gen Z and millennial kind of generation don't exist yet. Right. And so
true.
I think the idea of a job for life or doing the same thing for life,
right,
was kind of on the wane as I was coming into the workplace. But it feels a million miles away from where a young person is now, don't you think?
That's a really good insight. You're right. And when I think about, I don't have kids, but I think about my nieces who are, 19 and 17, and sure, the jobs that they're going to have 5, 10 years from now probably don't exist today.
Yeah.
So it's such a good point about how there's so much transition. And I also wonder, we're recording this during COVID, how that's going to affect job prospects for people, right? So I do think there's a number of factors that could make people feel that they need more feedback when they're entering the job market to find out, like, should I lean into this? Is this job even going to be here, or is my role going to change dramatically? Which are the skill sets that I should be leaning into? So I think you've got good insights there about that transitory or transient nature of work.
So let's talk about some practicalities. What I loved in the book was all the little sort of flow diagrams and scripts and really practical detail that I think will just really help people. If you're preparing for, a conversation that feels like it's going to be difficult, or you just really want to make it as good as it can be, I think there's just some really just useful, practical little nuggets there that people will take away.
Thank you.
Just before we talk about some of those, I love the bit where you talk about this kind of like three different views of what feedback should be, right? And so I just thought that was a really interesting insight in that there's been kind of almost like disagreements and just differing views on how to give feedback and the kind of feedback that really makes a difference. So do you want to talk about those three different views?
Yeah, sure. So there's in the United States, there's one view that's particularly big, and I think it's big there in the UK as well. Radical Candor, has that book done well there? Yeah. So Kim Scott takes the Radical Candor perspective. That's the name of her book, and that came out in 2017. That's been a big, her two mantras are care personally and challenge directly. Right. And so she is all about, you need to care about the person, but you still need to challenge them, and you need to challenge them directly. So she's in one camp. And then there's Ray Dalio, the CEO of Bridgewater, which is a financial services company. And he's in a very similar camp. He's about challenging directly.
Just with a bit less of the care, maybe.
Less care. I think there's a lot less care. He does not emphasize that. You're so right.
I actually had Daniel Scrivener on the podcast recently, who is the chief designer at Square. And we got onto a really interesting conversation where he started his career at Bridgewater and was basically telling me about just some horrendous experiences, actually, in terms of the way he was managed and just didn't want to manage other people like that.
Oh, it's rough. I interviewed one person for my book from Bridgewater, and the reason that I approached him, if I can tell a quick story, he was under a big tent. They were having a big all hands meeting for his division, and it was all the other managers. I can't remember the number. Let's just say it was like 200 different managers. So it's a big group, and someone's presenting a PowerPoint deck, and they said, here were the bottom 10 managers for our division, and they listed their names, and the guy that I interviewed was listed as the worst manager in the entire division. There's his name up there. Can you imagine? Oh my goodness. I mean, I know the UK and the US differ in terms of, how direct we might be, but still that is out there for the US, right? To like say that you're the worst manager in the company, right? And in any case, that captures some of Bridgewater, Ray Dalio's, not that Ray Dalio did that, but it captures some of the mentality of like, You got to be brutally honest with people. So he's in that camp. He's very much about the challenging directly. Sorry, were you going to say something?
I was just going to say, brutally honest, I think, is it that as well as being brutally honest, it's about being brutal? Like it feels like there's something in the culture at Bridgewater which really values helping people to grow a thick skin, in inverted commas, right?
And so interesting.
It's like you need to be really tough. So we're going to make it tough for you, and you need to survive. And then there's, I guess, an element of people who would just naturally leave from that environment, yes. And then they're left with the ones who they think are tougher. Do you think that's?
Yeah, it could very well be. It's not at least described. I haven't worked there, but what I've read about it, it's not described as, there's value in having a tough skin, but it's described, at least the way that it's sold publicly, is we want to figure out whose opinions are worth listening to.
Yeah.
And because we want to be savvy in our decision-making, we want to let people know what they're good at and what they're bad at so that we're always sorting people. You know, if I need to talk with someone who's really creative, who's the most creative person on the team, I can go and find out. I can see it publicly within Bridgewater. So it's sold as, this is the way that we call who's good at what, so that we don't waste any time, right? There's kind of the efficiency element.
So you've got the Ray Dalio approach, you've got radical candor, and then the third one,
Marcus Buckingham, and I'm forgetting his co-author right now, but they've written a book called Nine Lies About Work.
Somebody Goodall.
Goodall, yes. Yeah, Leslie Goodall. Thank you. Thanks for that help. I appreciate it. And they've written a book called Nine Lies About Work. And one of their key lies that they believe that we tell at work is that people need to hear the critical stuff. They're in the camp that people just need praise, that people are mostly need praise. They need it in so much higher proportion. And their observation is that if we're focused on what people do poorly, we're bringing someone who's a zero, maybe up to a five. But what we should really be focusing on, what they do well, what they're at a five now, so let's bring them up to a 10.
Yeah.
And I can see the wisdom in that, right? But on the other hand, just because someone's bad at something doesn't mean they can just avoid that part of their job, right? Particularly if you've got a small team, you need certain people to be doing the undesirable tasks or the tasks that no one's good at yet, but someone needs to get good at them. So those are kind of the three camps. You've got the radical candor, care personally and challenge directly. You've got Ray Dalio, his phrase is radical transparency. We're going to be super transparent about what everyone's strengths are and what their weaknesses are. And then you got the Goodall and Buckingham approach, which is praise, praise, praise. We need more praise.
So out of those three,
yeah,
which would you say is the one that you would naturally gravitate to the most?
I gravitate most towards Kim Scott's view, the challenge directly and care personally. The hesitation that I have with her approach is that we can fool ourselves into thinking that we're caring personally when perhaps that's not how the other person experiences it. She, in her book and in some of the talks that I've seen her give, she's very much focused on what's your intention as a manager. And if you have good intentions, that's what matters. I don't know if you've ever been on the receiving end of feedback where there was a good intention and it still didn't land well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
The story I shared at the beginning with my boss in the loo, where she probably had good intentions, but oh my goodness, yeah. Right? It was not when I wanted to hear it. So that's a concern for me. And there's also research out there showing that about 90% of us think that we have high emotional intelligence, when actually it's much more like 10%, right? Mm. So there are a whole bunch of us who think that we're very good at reading the other person's perspective. How are they taking this? When the truth is that we're not as good as we think we are. And so that's the concern I have about her approach, is that that people are getting away with, but I mean well. As long as I mean well, isn't that enough?
Yeah.
I'm trying to care. And my book takes more of an approach of, okay, here's what caring looks like. here's what caring is going to feel like to the other person. Here are strategies you can take. It's not enough just to come at it from a good intention.
Yeah. And you talk about a similar stat where it's a very high number of people who believe they have high levels of self-awareness, and then actually the number is very low.
Yes,
so
exactly.
I think that's like the floor of radical candor, I guess, is that a lot of people would believe that they themselves would be really good at that approach and have high levels of EQ.
Yes, exactly.
The stats just don't bear that out, right? Like so many of us feel like we're good at that, but maybe we're not.
Exactly. And I love radical candor. And I think, you know, I've talked with a lot of managers who've embraced it. And I think part of what is so appealing about it is it's an identity issue, right? For so many of us, if you're a manager, you feel like you can't say the hard stuff. And Kim Scott in Radical Candor is giving people permission to say the hard stuff. She's trying to help. How do you say the hard stuff? And I'm trying to lean even further into that. How, you know, what's the mindset around saying the hard stuff?
So should we talk about the different kinds of feedback? So I found that really interesting because I think I've probably thought about it before as there's one thing which is called giving feedback, right?
Yes, right.
And then you break it down into, and maybe part of that is the whole kind of, the kind of shit sandwich model, right?
Yes,
so
yeah.
Feedback is all about giving the negative stuff as well as the positive stuff and kind of mixing it all together. Mm. But you break it down into appreciation, coaching, and evaluation. So do you want to just say a bit more about the distinction between those things? Because I just thought that was really fascinating.
Oh, good. I'm glad. So I get that distinction. That's I didn't create that anew. That actually comes from Douglas Stone and Sheila Heen. They're authors of a book called Thanks for the Feedback, which is a great book, came out about a decade ago, about how to be better at receiving feedback when you're on the receiving end.
Right.
So that's a good book if you're someone who has a boss who's lousy at giving feedback and you're trying to figure out how do I think about this differently. So the three types, as you outlined, there's appreciation, which most of us would think of as praise, recognition, you know, it's what you're doing well and how you're having impact. It's the thing I want you to keep doing, Graham, whatever it is. That's appreciation, what I want you to keep doing. And then there's coaching, which would be advice or, you know, here's a direction I'd love to see you move in, or here's a way I'd like you to approach things differently. And then there's evaluation. And evaluation is, here's where you stand. So evaluation might be, are you on track to get that promotion that we talked about? Or evaluation might be, okay, compared to other people on the team, you know, your presentations are, they're the right length of time, but they're not as engaging as some of the other presentations for people on the team. So it's letting people know where they stand relative to others or relative to the goals they have.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So those are the three types. And I find it's really helpful because often there's often a mismatch. Somebody says, I want feedback, and their boss, their manager will give them like, atta girl, you're doing great. Don't worry about it. So they give them recognition and they're like, no, I really want some coaching now, but you don't have the language for it, right? So what I like about those terms is that it allows us to get more specific when we're asking for feedback to say, you know, actually, I need to know where I stand. Can you give me an evaluation? The coaching is nice, but I've had enough of that. I need to know, am I on track for that promotion in July?
That's a really nice tip, isn't it? So if you're talking to your manager about seeking feedback, just don't say give me feedback. Be more specific and ask for the one of those three things that you most need.
Exactly right. And there's fabulous research out of a team, Jaewon Yoon out of Harvard. One of the things that she has found is just there's one word that can make a huge difference, and that is, do you ask for feedback or do you ask for advice? And if they've done studies in real workplaces where when people ask for feedback, people are like to say, you did a great presentation. It was fine, you know, no complaints. But if they ask for, can you give me advice on my presentation? And now people will say, actually, you needed to move around a little bit more. You kind of stood in one place. Or, you know, there were two VPs in the room. If you had called on them, we would have then felt that this was, you know, authorized by the head honchos. So it's really interesting, just that small word difference, feedback versus advice. So I underline that point because it really can make a difference with your manager. You know, first of all, ask for advice, don't ask for feedback.
Yeah.
But secondly, if you let them know, I need to know where I stand, can you give me... I interviewed one manager who has the conversation once a month with his boss. He goes to his boss once a month and says, am I on track for that promotion a year from now? If not, what do you need to see from me? And I find that amazing that he has that conversation once a month, but he wants to make sure.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm counting on it. If you're not seeing what you need to see, plus it puts the thought in his manager's mind that like, you can't surprise me here, right?
Yeah,
you
know, like, yeah. This person's really hungry and I've have been telling them for 3 years that they're on track for the promotion, so I better give them one. Yeah.
Exactly. And I'm giving you every opportunity to let me know if that's not coming through.
Yeah, that's a pretty focused approach. Eh?
It really is. It's bold. And it's kind of funny because I sometimes find gender differences in the reaction to that story. Men are often like, oh, interesting. I'm going to try that. And women are like, no way would I ever.
I think I would find it a little bit icky to take that approach.
You mean as the person asking for it or the person receiving it?
I think both. I think I would struggle with asking that directly and that regularly. Mm. And I think if someone was doing that to me and asking that of me, I would recoil a little bit. And I think I would just be thinking, yeah. Oh, give me a break here. Like, we just had this conversation 3 weeks ago. We're having it again. You know, I don't know whether we'll have a role in the next 6 months or whatever.
Sure, there's that too, so, right?
You know, there's so many other unknowns that feed into that. So I wonder whether it might sometimes be too focused or backfire a little
bit. Well, that's really interesting. You know, it could backfire. And I think probably in part, you'd need to be reading your organization. You need to be reading your manager. There are definitely downsides to that approach. I know when I think about some of my employees, if they had done this, I probably would have given them the feedback like, there's so many things I can't control about the promotion process, right? Yeah. Like, but in the case of the person that I'm describing, he got a promotion every year for 3 years in a row, right? So for him, it was a winning strategy.
Yeah, we'll talk a bit more about gender a bit later as well, because I think that's a really interesting component of this. But let's just talk. I want to talk about listening as well, and you give lots of tips in the book, but just for anyone listening to this, what do you think are some of the main ways that you can be a better listener when you're trying to give and receive feedback?
Well, you know, I know from your work on how to be a productivity ninja that you're very focused on mindset, and there are definitely mindsets around listening that can really help you. So all too often we go into feedback conversations with a little script. I got these things I'm going to say. I want to say it this way. I practiced it at home in the mirror, you know, on my commute into work. But what the research shows is that what people want most is a really good listener when they're receiving feedback. They want the other person to be listening, not just telling them things. And so in terms of strategies for listening, one that I really like is give yourself two goals when you go into a conversation, any kind of conversation, because it's good to practice listening and it's a skill, you know, we can use across different situations. But two strategies that I really like for thinking about how to be a better listener is, first of all, when the conversation's done, can I say what was most important to that person? And that's number one. Can I say what was most important? Yeah. And number two, can I say how this person felt about the conversation? Right? Can I say how they felt about what they were talking about? Were they excited? Were they dreading something? Were they ambivalent? Whatever it might be. But if you can say those two things, you can say what was most important to the person and how they felt about it, you're on your way to becoming a really good listener. And it's something you can practice with your partner at home tonight, right? Or with a friend. It's surprisingly hard to do. But if you go into a conversation with those two goals, you're going to become a much better listener, and you'll be much better at feedback because you're now tuned into, okay, what is most important to this person? You know, they've been missing deadlines. I'm trying to understand why that's happening. Why do they think, what do they see as important in this conversation?
That's lovely. Just such a nice mindset to go into things with. The other one I really liked as a little device in the practice section of the book is stop asking questions that start with the word why. And then flip it around into questions that are about what. So do you want to say a bit more about that? Because I just thought that was such a useful little tip and trick that it's just one of those memorable things that you can take away, isn't it?
It is. It really is. People get defensive when you ask a why question, you know. So if I were to, you know, ask you like, you know, you happen to be wearing a blue shirt. So Dan, why why the blue today? Yeah. You know, right? You're just like, what's wrong with blue? Right? Right, exactly. But why immediately? If you get the tone slightly wrong, it puts people in a defensive, you know, they're on their back heels. And so just reframing it as a what question. So one that I really like is, or a how question, how does that help you achieve what you want? Or, you know, what was your goal there? That's instead of why did you do that? What was your goal there? Or how does that achieve what you want? And it's more wordy, but it won't put people on the defensive. I do it a lot in my consultations. And when you ask people like, how does that achieve what you want? They go into their goals. And now you understand, okay, if that's your goal, here's a different way to get there. It's the longer route, but it's going to be so much more effective for you.
And also the discussion becomes about their goals, right? So then you're having a whole, okay, cool. So if that's your goal, then I suggest we work in this way. So you're having the conversation more on their terms than on your terms.
Exactly. Right. And people want you to meet them where their goals are, right? As opposed to if you're giving the feedback that you did something wrong, it seems like now it's about my issues, not about the issues that are important to the person you're giving the feedback to. So exactly. Yeah. Make it about their goals.
Yeah. I love that. And yeah, I think use the example in the book, what were you hoping would happen? Which I think is just a really good question. You know, like particularly if the feedback relates to, you know, a situation or an event where something didn't go so well, like what were you hoping would happen? And how did you think that it went? And so not saying, why did you behave in that way? Or,
why on earth? Happen? Right. What were you hoping would happen? Because that is also a beautiful question because it gives you insight into how self-aware that person is, right? We talked about self-awareness earlier. Yeah. Is that person really aware of, do they have situational awareness? Do they know the impact they have on others? Were their expectations really unrealistic? You know, they thought the VP was going to stand up and applaud them at the end of their talk. Right. Like, okay. The VP never does that. Right? So it's a nice question to get a sense, to get a read on how thoughtful and aware the other person is.
And just before we move off that topic area, because it does feel so important, that whole area of you know, empathy, emotional intelligence, listening, so central to feedback, that personal connection. Is there anything else you think would be useful for people to take away, just as, you know, devices or just tips that can really help people to be more present, be more in the conversation, connect more?
Yeah, I think the one other tip, and I appreciate you're not asking me for like a 3-step formula because I don't find
the first thing when you do podcasts, right? Yeah.
Right, exactly. That's so like, oh, I don't know if I had a reductionist approach, what would I do? but there is one more tip that I find even I will forget to do, but it makes such a difference when I remember to do it. And that is to state my good intentions when I'm giving someone either coaching or evaluation. When you're giving appreciation, you're letting someone know what you love about their work. You know, when I'm telling you what I love about your podcast, I probably don't need to say, you know, what my good intentions are. But when you're giving coaching or evaluation, when you're giving someone advice or you're letting them know where they stand, it's important to say, you know, I want to see you do your best work. You know, I want to see you succeed. You know, Graham, I see you putting all this work into this podcast, and I want to help you get where you want to go. And it might sound artificial, but to the other person, now they're like, again, we get back to this question of recognizing my goals. And the other person will be, there's research from Leslie John at Harvard Business School showing that if you state your good intentions before you give bad news, the other person is much more receptive to the bad news. So it's a small thing. It's easy to forget, but when you do it, the other person, you'll see them relax and be much more open.
I'm definitely guilty of neglecting that one, I would say. And the other one I do quite a lot is when you're giving feedback on email and stuff, is launch straight in with the one tiny detail that's wrong about this thing rather than, you know, actually 99% of this is brilliant, you know, but like in my mind, it's like, cool, so it's brilliant. So here's the bit that, you know, and so particularly if you're in that busy kind of mode and email, you don't have the person in front of you. So there's just less of that connection. It's really easy. I think I probably, it's pretty one of the main sources of frustrations of people working with me probably is that sort of, you know, pernickety change this tiny thing email that they get back from me, right?
Yeah. Well, and I can't remember the data on this, but I've seen studies that we also have many more critical adjectives. We have more negative adjectives than we have positive adjectives, you know. So it's really easy to just say, well, that was good, that was fine, that was great work. But then we get into very specific details about, you know, this was too wordy, or, you know, whatever it might be, right? But we have much more language about what was wrong than we do about what was right. So we really need to counteract that negativity bias.
And then the other thing about adjectives, let's talk about the gender adjectives thing.
Sure. Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's a nice little segue there, little podcast segue.
Very nicely done.
So was this a Harvard study? But it basically found that there are certain adjectives that people would use in feedback to describe female leaders, and then a whole nother set of adjectives that people would use about predominantly about male leaders.
Yeah. So there was a study done at Harvard. I think it was through the Kennedy School for Public Policy, but they analyzed actual performance reviews. And there have also been studies done in the military. There have been a couple of studies like this where they find that different adjectives are used for men and women. And the adjectives that are used more frequently for women. So there are some adjectives that are used across both men and women, right? In terms of, like, you know, this is excellent work, or you contribute in important ways. So there are certain phrases or language, intelligent, that's used for both men and women. But then when we look at the adjectives that are used more predominantly for women or more predominantly for men, it's really fascinating, the patterns. So for women, there'll be comments about how kind you are, how compassionate you are, how helpful you are, really focusing on a lot of gender stereotypes around being likable and nice and nurturing.
I thought enthusiastic was an interesting one.
Oh, enthusiastic is interesting. Yeah. And I'm surprised by that too. Because there's other research that shows, at least when professors are being described, men, male professors are more likely to be described as enthusiastic.
Okay.
So there's maybe it depends on the field that you're in.
Mm.
But anyway, kind, compassionate, focusing a lot on helpfulness.
Helpful.
Whereas, you know, get ready for it. What are the adjectives for men? They're things like game changer, visionary, innovative. And when you think about who you want to promote, you know, in any job, do you want to promote the person who's compassionate and helpful, or the person who's a visionary game changer? I mean, maybe there are some jobs, maybe if you're doing nursing, you want the kind, compassionate person.
But don't want a room full of geniuses when you're nursing.
I have had so many good nurses. Of course, I want them to be geniuses, but I mostly want them to be helpful and kind, right? But in any case, when you think about who's going to stand out as management material, it's probably more likely to be the innovative person, or these adjectives that we're using for men, not for women. And I find that work fascinating, because that's an inadvertent slip that so many of us could make, and pointing it out. One of the things I suggest in the book is, you know, if you're a manager, close your door, get out your performance reviews from last year and look for these words. You know, did you make these mistakes for men and women?
Yeah. I was having a conversation with someone a little while ago about the word genius and how it's so often, you know, people will refer to men as a genius, and it's not a word that you hear a lot of women described as, and it's kind of like this cultural thing. And I'd never really noticed it before. And one thing was, a few weeks later, I was in my friend's WhatsApp group, and I was talking about the lyrics of a female songwriter, and I was like, genius. And the first thing back was someone questioning, oh no, that's just a really obvious lyric. And I was like,
that's fascinating.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
I really had just not even considered that as it being a kind of, you know, gender bias thing. But fascinating.
It is fascinating. And there, you know, it's interesting there. I can't remember where the study was done now, but there was a study looking at different academic disciplines that tend to be more male and female dominated. And, you know, we tend to think of men are more likely, or at least more likely to have careers in science, and women more likely to have careers in the humanities. But what's fascinating is there are certain fields like philosophy where men are much more common, even though that's in the humanities. But philosophy, like physics, like software engineering, a couple of different areas where we think people have to be genius to do it, right? Whereas women are less likely to go into these careers that are described as genius. I'm not saying that you're not a genius if you go in the social sciences, but it's not a word that's associated with that. Whereas genius is associated with more male-dominated fields.
Interesting. And you talk about a thing called the Harvard Implicit Association Test.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So this is a way that you can basically check for unconscious biases. Is that just around gender? Is that a much wider unconscious bias test as well?
It's much wider. Have you ever taken one?
I've never done it, but I wrote it down today because I was thinking, I'm gonna do that.
Yeah. You know, when you've got some free time, you know, they take about 10 minutes, but they do have them across a variety. So I'm not associated with Harvard at all on this. So, but it is a free test, and your data would go into their data banks, but they let you know that if you want to do it. But what's fabulous is they've got at least 10 different tests where you can discover, you basically need to take 10 minutes, but you're going to discover how biased you are relative to all the other people who've taken that test. And they've got hundreds of thousands of people who've taken these, and they'll give you your data at the end. You don't have to wait for the report. They give it to you right away. They let you know, where do you stand relative to other people? And they give you, you know, you have options. You can, they've got a couple on gender bias. They've got a few on race. They've got them on how do you view Muslims, for instance? How do you view thin people versus heavy people? How do you view people who are fully abled versus people who have disabilities? So you get to pick ahead of time which of these things you want to do. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I've got to say, I have taken a couple of them now, and there are some where I'm like, I can't be that biased. I'm going to take it again. And what's beautiful is you can do it again, and then you get almost the same score. And it's like, oh no, you know. So I highly recommend it. It's a very humbling experience.
Yeah, in my book Study Ninja, I researched and listed a number of different biases, and I can't remember what it's called, but there is a bias which basically says, even when you are aware of biases, you will still be biased, right? So even when, you know, you look at these things and know that bias is something that 90% of people have, and you know that you have biases, you will still then just do things exactly the same.
Yeah, you know, I really like, there's she used to be chair of the psychology department. Her name is Banaji. She has this great analogy that I really like around unconscious bias. Her observation is exactly what you're saying, that just because you know about unconscious bias doesn't mean you're free from it. She said, you know, there's this unrealistic expectation that if we learn about unconscious bias, it will go away. We will now be more enlightened, and we won't have unconscious bias. She said, but that's like expecting that if you go to a talk on how we burn calories and how we burn fat, that you'll suddenly like lose weight, right?
Yeah.
You know, just because you understand how it works doesn't mean that your internal machinery has changed. It just means you're now aware of it, but you still need to take extra steps for any change to happen.
Yeah, we've had a big problem in, there's a couple of big problems in our big political parties here and I'm saying that for balance. The one that the media covers all the time is the Labour Party having a big problem with anti-Semitism.
Sure.
Actually, the Conservative Party have an equally big problem with Islamophobia, but the media just don't talk about that. I wonder who funds the media, but that's another story.
The Labour
leader recently was being interviewed about this review into anti-Semitism, and he is on a big campaign, the current Labour leader, to really stamp it out. And I think, to his credit, has taken some quite big action, you know, in order to try and make the point that he is on this crusade to sort of stamp out, you know, like anti-Semitism, but also other, you know, racism or biases within the party. And someone asked him, what action are you taking internally? And he said, everybody internally has been on this unconscious bias training. And the interviewer said, and how long was the training? And he was like, well, it was 2 hours. And it was like, oh, so you think that you're just, everything's fixed if everyone just goes on a course for 2 hours, you know? So there is a sense where that needs to be the starting point rather than the end point.
Exactly right.
I just thought it was quite a funny It was a funny moment that the questioner managed to uncover.
I really like that reality test. 2 hours, 2 hours, and that's
exactly,
it.
Exactly. Huh? Yeah. Right. We've got about 10 minutes left, and I'd love to just talk to you more about the work that you do. So you were the founding director of something called the Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning at Seattle University. So I'd love to just know about how that came about and what do you do at the Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning?
Sure. Well, you know, I have so much admiration there in the UK. You take higher education and, you know, we take higher education seriously here, but there you really take it seriously about university professors and making sure that they're good at their work, and you take it more seriously than we do. I used to be a university professor for the beginning of my career, and I realized I wanted to think about, how do you help other professors get good at their jobs? How can I help people go from being a good professor to being your favorite professor? And because, yeah, you know, it's one thing to be good for the 30 or 50 students in your class. It's another thing to help professors across the university get good at what they do. And there are jobs like that. And so I moved into that line of work. In the US, it's called faculty development. And I think in the UK, it's called higher education development. And basically what that work involves is I sit down with faculty, with university professors all the time. And sometimes they're in law, sometimes they're in nursing, sometimes they're in philosophy. It's across the university. And I work with them to figure out how can they teach better. And so that involves a lot of feedback. I've been doing that since about 2000. So I've had about 20 years now of giving a lot of feedback to help those professors be smarter in their classrooms. And some of those conversations are easy and wonderful, and some of them are hard because a person is seeking feedback, but they don't really want it, right?
Yeah, right.
we've all been there. We think we want to know, but we don't once we hear it. Anyway, and it's fabulous work. I really, it's very fulfilling. And I've had a chance to see some professors really go from being average to exceptional. And I feel really lucky to be part of that work.
It sounds like one of those jobs where there would always be more to do, and your relationship with busy might be a tricky one. So just tell us about that, and you know, how you manage your relationship with busy.
You're right. And that is managing your relationship with busy. What a wonderful way to put it. It is work where there's always more to do. And the better you are at your job, the more people seek you out. Getting good at the job has complicating consequences.
Sounds
definitely
just, professional dilemmas and so on. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, and I think for me, a part of that job was to figure out which parts of the job I enjoy most. Can I carve the work out so that I'm getting to do the parts of the work that I enjoy most? I enjoy research and writing, and I enjoy working one-on-one with people. That's my favorite part of the job.
Yeah.
As founding director, I was also pulled into meetings. You want to show off. If you're building a new library, you want to have the director of teaching and learning there, right?
Yeah.
Even if that's just someone who's nodding along at the table. And so I tried to move out of fewer of those, basically where I was just a token in the room.
So you were like the Lord Mayor of Seattle University.
No, hardly, but I was maybe the Lord Mayor of teaching and learning.
At least
how it was learned, how it was viewed. So I really enjoy that work. But the productivity for me, in terms of productivity tips, right? For me, setting aside large blocks of time whenever I can get them to write, and figuring out for me when my best time is for certain tasks.
Yeah.
So I try to do meetings in the morning and my writing and research in the afternoon, because I find that I do my best writing from 3 to 6, that those words work on the page the first time. Whereas if I try to write at 9 in the morning or 10 in the morning, I'm rewriting and rewriting. I'm not sure that my meetings are my best in the morning, but they don't seem to suffer nearly as much as my writing does. For me, is that something that you find? Do you dial in certain times of the day?
Yeah, I do exactly the same in principle, but exactly the opposite in practice to you. So my mornings are I label as the create time. My morning time is the writing, and then the afternoon time is the meetings. And So we're kindred spirits in our sports teams, and then actually polar opposites in terms of which times of the day work best for our writing. But I find that having to make those choices and compromises, mm-hmm. like you say, I think I'd rather a meeting go from being 100% of what it could be to being 90%, because actually usually 90% of a meeting is good enough. Whereas with writing, there's such a difference between when you feel 100% on your game and when you feel at 90%. It's like the difference is so huge. And I think for me, sometimes, you know, I don't know if you get this, but I sometimes feel a bit guilty if I know people need time in my diary and I'm, you know, steadfastly defending my time boundaries around, you know, when I need that writing time. I feel really guilty about that, but it is so important, isn't it? When you've got something like writing that, you know, you do just need to prioritize your energy for.
You do. And for me, at least, you know, when I think about some of the least successful feedback conversations that I've had where I've had a meeting with someone, it's often a mistake that I'm making. I'm having it at 4 p.m. in the afternoon, and I'm tired, and this person needs me to be a great listener, right?
Yeah.
And instead, they're just sucking out all of my energy, and so I'm not able to be, because I'm not coming into it fresh. And so I do think that I'm doing people a favor by saying, you know, I need to have my meetings done by 3, if at all possible. If they're meetings that matter. Again, if I'm just a token head in the room, I can do that at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock. But in terms of my actually being able to give good feedback and be the kind of listener you expect to show up, I'm going to do that better earlier in the day. So I do think, but I know that there are probably some of your listeners who think, gosh, Therese, that's a luxury. I don't get to set my agenda or I don't get to set my schedule the way that it sounds like you do. So I think trying to find ways to take control of your time is so important.
Yes. And I think that's the sliding scale, right? So we probably both have quite a high level of autonomy over our time, but I would say that everybody has some level of autonomy, even if that's an hour a day or half an hour of your day that you can control yourself.
Right.
I think what you do with that and how you try and organize that, you know, that can make a huge difference, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And to communicate that, you know, to the people, to your boss, to say, you know, if I can have my first 2 hours of my day to work on my reports, or I can spend my first 2 hours getting that data done, I'm going to be so much more effective at what you need me to do for the rest of the day. Often bosses are like, okay, well, if you figured that out, let's try it. Right. And, yeah. And people can be more receptive to that if you can articulate it.
Final question for you, which is, I often describe Productivity Ninja, the book, as like a rod for my own back, because then it becomes, oh, Graham has to be productive all the time. Oh. So do you feel like with this book and obviously your work around feedback, do you feel like it creates a rod for your own back where you're never allowed to be the person who gives bad feedback or or isn't on top of your game when it comes to those things?
Well, I don't know if this happens for you. The key hesitation I had when I was going to write this book at the beginning was I was dreading those moments where I'll be giving a talk and someone will have a question and basically they're going to present to you their very hardest feedback situation ever. What would you do if, right?
Yeah.
And I was dreading that. I was just like, oh, these, you know, people are, it's going to come out of the woodwork, the hardest of all the possible feedback situations. So there's, for me, there's that concern, is that I'm going to get all these questions that where people try to stump me, you know, try to stump the feedback giver. But I usually find that it's hard to, you know, you can't be an armchair feedback giver. You can't just like slide in and say, here's what you need to do and slide back out, right? But usually there's a relationship. Is there a good relationship or there's not a good relationship? Have I been giving you recognition and appreciation all along? So now you're comfortable hearing where you stand and it's not quite where you need to be. So anyway, I really like the way that you frame, you know, what do you want to get good at? Because people are going to expect you to be good at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah. And with me, my next book's about kindness. So I kind of feel like not only do I have to be on time to everything now, but I have to be super kind in every situation of my life. So what am I doing? It's going to get stressful, isn't it?
It's going to get stressful. You're going to have 2 hours a day where you interact with the world. You know, those are your kind
Indeed,
hours,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, it's been lovely having you on Beyond Busy. And before we go, do you want to just tell people where they can connect with you and find out more about your work?
Yeah, sure. So you can find me at therisehouston.com. And I'm sure Graham will put my name in the podcast notes. So you'll see how to spell that. And then my book is being published in the UK by Penguin Random House. So you'll be able to find it at your favorite bookseller. And I'd love for you to pick it up and let me know. You can email me. My email's on my website. And I'd love to hear what parts of the book work for you and what parts don't.
And presumably you'll be reading all of the feedback that comes in the form of Amazon reviews, right?
Exactly. Yes. You know, I'll probably skip the reviews where people say, you know, it didn't ship on time, right? I'll skip those, but you know, I pay attention to the others. I'm true to my word. I love feedback.
Amazing. Therese, thanks so much for being on Beyond Busy.
Oh, you're such a delight. Thank you, Graham.
Really enjoyed that. And just before we finish, because my throat is absolutely just dying, so I'm not going to do a big long spiel here, but I just have to give two thank yous before we finish. First is to Teresa. So she asked me at the end of our conversation if she could send me a thank you card and what was my address. And I said, oh, that'd be great, because my gran collects stamps and she loves getting the foreign stamps. And so, you know, when your card arrives, it's going to be really great to have a nice picture stamp. And Teresa kind of took that as a little challenge. She sent me this whole little envelope full of like picture stamps from the States, with like, you know, there's some with like famous screen actors on, there's some with really exotic looking birds on them and stuff, and just this whole array of different stamps. So I'm thrilled with it, and my gran is going to love it, and that's really cool. So thank you to Teresa for doing that. And do you know what, we don't get enough of that sort of, you know, physical mail and just like physical stuff. Everything's so digital now that when you get them, they're just so exciting. So really nice to receive a lovely thank you card and stamps. Just really made my day when that arrived just a few days ago, actually. And the second thank you is to my producer on the show, Mark Steadman. This is actually the final episode that Mark is going to be producing. We're moving to a new producer who is part of our team, Riz Paredes, who will be taking it over next week. And so this is like the end of a bit of an era, really. So we've just passed our 100th episode, but Mark has been really at my side with this podcast from day one, and his platform Podiant is where we host the podcast as well. So literally everything from the format to the technical setup to the editing, like, he's really just been such a mine of useful information, such a resource, such a support, and I've really loved working with him. So we will still be on Podiant. Mark will be putting his time into lots of other stuff, so is no longer going to be producing each of the episodes, but I'm sure we'll still be a friend and a fan of this podcast, as well as a host, obviously, through Podiant as well. So just want to say thank you, Mark. It's been amazing working with you. I know we will continue to to work with each other and to send people each other's direction and all that sort of stuff. But just want to say a massive thank you to Mark Steadman and everybody at Podiant. This episode is sponsored by Think Productive. So if you want productivity training and coaching, go to thinkproductive.com. And as always, you can get all the show notes, all the links to previous episodes, including our three-part Beyond Busy 100. It's all at getbeyondbusy.com. If you want to sign up for my weekly email, it is just go to grahamalcott.com/links, and you'll find it on there amongst a few other things. And that's it. We've got a huge guest next week. Seth Godin is our guest next week on Beyond Busy. So make sure you're subscribed and strap in for that one. It's a good one. We're talking about his book, The Practice. So until then, I hope you're keeping well. I'm going to get myself better because my throat is killing me and I just feel awful. And I'm sure that by next week I'll be feeling a bit brighter than I probably sound here. So take care. See you next week. Bye for now.